Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This year marks Charlotte's Sester Centennial, our 250th birthday. We began when British Royal Governor William Tryon signed our charter on December 3rd, 1768. Then we were even less than the trifling place George Washington would later describe us as being, just a crossing of two Native American trading paths, which became Trade and Tryon. Our name was chosen to honor Queen Charlotte, King George III's bride, and Mecklenburg County was named after her German homeland, Mecklenburg-Strelitz. From inauspicious beginnings, Charlottetown has grown to the point it's nearly impossible to find evidence of those beginnings. But we have two historians here to take us through our history and to talk about how our past continues to inform our present and our future. For years, Tom Henchett was staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. Today he writes about history and culture at historysouth.org. He's also written a couple of books, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Indeed.
You want to put a plug in for your books?
A book called Sorting Out the New South City, about how Charlotte became a city of neighborhoods. And then I've written parts of many other books, including a book called Legacy, the Myers Park Story.
Well, welcome back. And Adria Vogt is with us. She's president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History. Thank you for being back with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dan Morrill, who is kind of the dean of historians in Charlotte, was supposed to be with us this morning, but had a little family emergency and couldn't be at the last minute. And I was going to start with the question to him, but I'll ask it to you instead, because he sent along a little talking point. And I was kind of shocked when I read it. He said the future is more important than the past. And for an historian, that seems to be blasphemy. The future is more important than the past. But he says the most important issue is how an awareness of Charlotte's past can affect our future. You agree with that, Adria? You're nodding.
Absolutely. I think that's a really strong point. I think that we don't preserve history for history's sake, but to understand the present, how we got to now, and how we're going to get to a brighter future.
Okay.
And history is how stuff got to be this way. And if you want to make things better, you need to know how stuff got to be this way. So that sort of using history build community is something that Levine Museum of the New South does and that we're doing every day, I think, in this community.
You came here as a kind of an accident. You came here to be Dan Morrill's first research assistant, I think.
At Historic Landmarks Commission.
Right, and everybody told you, where are you from originally?
Kind of everywhere, like most Charlatans. I was born in Chicago, but I grew up in upstate New York. And
everybody told
came
you,
in 81.
Everybody told you to go to Charlottesville or Charleston. That's our CH factor problem, right? There, instead of Charlotte, because there's no history here.
Oh, there's tremendous history. But we've been growing so quickly that we haven't saved much of right. The old stuff. Now, the Historic Landmarks Commission has saved more and designated and saved more landmarks than any other community in North Carolina. But the sort of secondary buildings, the background buildings that form most of the landscape in most American cities, something gets to be 30, 40 years old here, and the city will have doubled in population, and we're just eager to do something new.
Well, that's what Dan says is one of the two constant themes throughout the history of Charlotte from the very beginning, from day one. Actually, it predates day one because the reason we're here is the unremitting desire for growth and expansion. And you say economic development and jobs are great, Adria, but we have to think carefully about how to preserve our cultural landscape. But we've been on this tear for 250 years now. How do you stop it? How do you change it?
Well, I think we have to focus the attention on preservation as economic development. When you preserve historic structures, you're preserving the authenticity of a place, which attracts young people, it attracts new workers, and it serves as economic development because you can have these historic buildings that will work for entrepreneurs. It's a lower price point. It helps with that diversity in economic neighborhoods.
You also talk about these older buildings helping to give a city a soul.
Mm-hmm.
Does Charlotte have a soul? Or are we Atlanta? Which I think is a city with no soul. None.
I think both of those, both of our cities have souls. But I think it's very important to preserve what remains of our historic structures.
Atlanta has Coca-Cola. That is not a soul.
Well, the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site. I think there's a lot of soul in that place if you ever get to visit. Yeah.
I love the contrast. I walked downtown or uptown, one of the two, last week in the evening and just stopped cold when I saw the lights on in the windows of Spirit Square, the old First Baptist Church from the 19-teens. And right next to it, where I was standing, was the tower of the Bank of America Corporate Center.
Right.
And there's a lot of Charlotte history right there.
Well, let's talk about this. Let's begin at the beginning, the very beginning. Why are we, Charlotte, here? Because most cities of significance are on a body of water, on a significant body of water. And they could have put us to the west a couple of miles, and we'd be on the banks of the Catawba. Why are we here?
Because that wasn't a significant body of water. We're up above the fall line. And if you look at where the big cities are in the era before the railroad, do they tend to be ports, or they tend to be places like Richmond or Albany or Columbia, places where the first set of waterfalls are? And if you're running up and down the river in a boat, the first set of waterfalls, you don't want to much go beyond that, because you have to pick your boat up and take it out of the water and portage it around the falls. And so here in the backcountry or the upcountry, the thing to settle along was a Native American trading route. And we are on the nation's path, which kind of glued together all of the Indian nations way back in the day. If you come up I-77, there's Nations Ford, which is an exit on I-85 now, but that was where the path, coming up from what's now Georgia, South Carolina, crossed the Catawba River, heading up towards what's now Richmond. And if that sounds like the route of Interstate 85, we are on the colonial equivalent of Interstate 85. We're a trading city. That was a trading path. We're still a trading city.
So 250 years ago, this was a backwater, backwoods wilderness. There was nothing here. It was just these two trading paths that kind of crisscrossed at what is now Trade and Tryon. Why did people settle here? What did they do when they got here?
They came here first and foremost to carve out a new existence in this backcountry. And this particular area, this 360 acres that Charlotte's founding fathers purchased to form the city of Charlotte, it was rich both in farming soil, and it did have natural springs. So while it didn't have large bodies of waters, large rivers, it did have natural springs, which served the new inhabitants of this area. I did want to go back to one point that you had said about starting at the beginning, and I think Tom hit on that, you know, the beginning really truly in Charlotte, before Charlotte became a city, was the Native American history here, and that's for some 10,000 years prior to this, 250th anniversary
celebrating. We rarely hear about that, and these people, the Native Americans, were here 10,000 years before mm-hmm. Charlotte was even mm-hmm. the glimmer in someone's eye. Who were they?
They were the Catawba, the Sugary, the Watery, and the ancestors of those people. So there were many, many tribes that existed here in this Carolina Piedmont region when the first Europeans came to this area. And they described some 250 individual tribes just in the state. We now have one federally recognized tribe in the state of North Carolina, and that's the Eastern Band of the Cherokee.
Okay. But if you go south on 77 into South Carolina, you'll see the Catawba Indian Community Center. And if you head southeast, you'll come to Indian Trail. If you go into South Carolina past Ballantyne, you'll come to Indian Land. If you look at the boundary of North and South Carolina, there's this kind of diamond-shaped notch just below at the bottom of Mecklenburg County.
Right.
That was the old Catawba lands from way back in the colonial era.
Okay. 250 years ago, actually prior to that, who were the settlers that came here? Where did they come from?
So it was really just about the 1750s that you saw this influx of Scots-Irish settlers coming from the Pennsylvania and Maryland area.
And why would they? They've already gone into the wilderness of Pennsylvania and Maryland, because let's face it was all wilderness. What was their impetus to move back into another new wilderness and start all over?
We may have to ask some of them that. But I think those stories are going to be individual stories for the families. But also there was new territories to be settled and to be explored. So in Pennsylvania, Maryland, a lot of those counties, towns had been established, mm-hmm. and this was a new adventure for them, a new life.
I read that these Scots-Irish farmers were tired of paying taxes to the Anglican Church mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and constantly fighting with the Native American population. Mm-hmm. Why did they think they could not fight here against the Native American population?
Catawba were very receptive to trade, and right. The Catawba allowed for a good trading relationship with settlers in this area. I think that was a big draw for them as well.
So when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about who these people were that actually decided, we're going to buy some land on what is now the square, mm-hmm. and we're going to kind of force the hand of the royal governor to make this a town and call it Charlottetown. We'll do that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. So you thought you could listen to the Charlotte Talks podcast without having to hear about WFAE's end of fiscal year campaign. Not only does listener support keep our show on the air, it also helps pay for the server space for you to enjoy Charlotte Talks on demand. We need your financial support right now. Head to WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the founding of Charlottetown 250 years ago this year. Tom Hanchett is here. He's a historian and a writer with the blog HistorySouth.org. And Adria Focht is president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History. According to, I think,
Jim Williams.
Jim Williams.
Mecklenburg Historical Association.
Who wrote a special article for the Charlotte Observer, a longtime researcher with the Mecklenburg Historical Association. The story of Charlotte's founding is really more interesting than the governor simply signing a charter, and one that is unusual for the time. What is the story? He didn't have to do this. He was cattle prodded into doing this, essentially.
Oh, yeah. Charlotte started out with a real estate deal, and that's
what a
very
surprise.
Charlotte.
Did Alan Tate do it?
Yeah, what it was the settlers were coming here, a lot of them Scots-Irish, a lot of them Presbyterian, which is why we have a lot of early Presbyterian churches, and they settled around this Native American crossroads, and they started to want a town, and so they laid out a town, and they built a courthouse, because if you were a courthouse, then you were a center of energy. They didn't have public television back there, so if you wanted people to go watch people argue, you couldn't see Judge Judy in the afternoon. You had to come down to the courthouse. That's where the market would be. And so they did all of that kind of thing. They put up their own money. They built their own courthouse. They laid out the town lots. And then they went to the General Assembly and said, please allow us to do this.
Who were they that they could do this? They bought this land. Who did they buy it from? It was just wilderness.
It was unused land by Lord Selwyn, so it was just unused land at the time. But they bought it for a premium because they knew they had this vision for what this place would become.
How did Lord Selwyn get it?
Probably from a land grant from the king.
Okay. So they bought this land. They did tracts on it. They laid it out, mm-hmm. their future plans.
And then they asked permission.
Okay, and they built this courthouse, and that was simply for commerce purposes. They wanted to make money off the fact that they bought this land, and so they go to the governor, William Tryon at the time, the royal governor, and he says, okay. They take it to the General Assembly first, right?
Right. And the General Assembly considers it in the fall of 1768, and then on December 3rd, the colonial governor signs the
charter,
and well, it's not really a charter, but it's a permission to do what they've been doing already, and makes them the county seat.
How many towns were there in what is now North Carolina at the time? Do we know?
I couldn't give you an exact number. Salisbury was a big one. New Bern were significant towns.
Yeah, the big cities were down east. New Bern was the biggest because it was the best port in this state of North Carolina. South Carolina had the best port, Charleston, of course.
So this charter that was signed 250 years ago, does this charter exist?
I have a copy right here. It actually exists in the North Carolina State Archives. But this is it, an act for establishing a town in Mecklenburg County. It's 4 pages long. It was signed by the handful of Mecklenburg County residents that were here putting up their own money and starting this town. And I think what's really interesting about it is that it talks about sort of the potential of it. And it says, because of its location for trade, because of the healthiness of the place, and of course, you're talking about the natural springs and the farmland, it says it might soon become considerable if it was erected into a town by lawful authority. So once you have your courthouse, you have lawful authority, and it might soon become considerable.
By the way, you asked the names of the founders, and Jim Williams with Mecklenburg Historical Association says Thomas Polk, John Frohock, and Abraham Alexander.
Okay. We were chartered in 1768, 250 years ago. That makes us older than the United States, but there are a lot of towns that predate the United States, obviously. We also predate the Continental Congress and the Declaration of Independence, which came into being in 1776. But the so-called Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, the MEC DEC, allegedly predated the Philadelphia document. It allegedly came into being a year earlier in 1775. So it didn't take long from our founding in 1768 to the creation of the MEC DEC. Did this unrest that led to the MEC DEC allegedly, is that something that's born in our DNA here in Charlotte, this distrust of authority, this rebellious nature?
I believe so. I think that was always sort of the backcountry mentality was I carved this land out for myself and I will defend it. And I think there was that sentiment here. I think wasn't our motto that's now on the marker for the courthouse is something like leave us alone. So we had that mentality. Absolutely.
But there's also the religious component, as you mentioned. Colonial government was Anglican. And that was a time when there was a state religion in England and here in the colonies, and the Presbyterians, the Scots-Irish, did not want to be part of that. And so even though we named ourselves after the wife of the king,
right.
We were looking to do our own thing, I think, even before 1775.
So the charter that established Charlotte still exists. It's in Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a photocopy of it. It's handwritten. It looks just like the Declaration of Independence on parchment with very nice handwriting, beautiful handwriting, and no mistakes. It always fascinates me that these people did these beautiful, longhand documents, and there's never anything scratched out. It's amazing to me. I couldn't write a sentence without scratching something out if I had to handwrite it. But what's your take on the MEC DEC? Conrad emails us, and we've talked ad nauseum about this on past shows, but a lot of historians these days, he says, like to think it was a collective hallucination or a misremembering of the Mecklenburg Resolve. Did it exist? Because the document doesn't exist. Do you think it happened?
The Mecklenburg Resolves are a real thing because they were published in newspapers and they show up in the colonial records. And that is at the end of May. And the wording is that the authority of the king and crown are, quote unquote, null and void. And whether there was an earlier document on May 20th, 1775, it doesn't show up in the colonial records. It doesn't show up in the newspapers. If there was, it didn't have much impact.
Hmm.
But the resolves had tremendous impact.
The charter, we took the name Charlottetown, and we took the name Charlottetown because of Queen Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, Germany, allegedly to curry favor of King George III. What were we hoping to get out of the king, and did we? Did he even know that we existed?
I've heard this question before. I think the intent was to curry favor, but I also I doubt that it had any major impact.
Hmm. Well, what do we hope to get? What kind of favor would he bestow upon
us? Being a courthouse was a big deal.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the notice me thing that a lot of communities were doing back at that
time. So how many people lived here at the time?
Only a few hundred, less than 1,000 people.
That's actually a lot. I'm surprised you didn't say 30. I'm serious. I mean, there was nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, there was nothing here. You have a diorama mm-hmm. at the museum.
We do.
And you can see how the town was laid out in those early years. You can see the courthouse. The diorama is a three-dimensional depiction of Charlotte. Is that Charlotte at its founding on this day, 250 years ago, or was it later on?
That is from 1776 is the portrayal.
Okay.
The
so diorama. Not that long ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, not mm-hmm. that far from the founding. It didn't
yes.
take long.
Mm-hmm.
Given the backcountry nature of this town, why did the governor and the General Assembly think that we were a good place to charter a town? Is it simply because they were pressured into doing so? And could they have said no? Have they said no to other people who were petitioning? Do you know?
They had a large enough population at the time to separate into this separate county of Mecklenburg. And they had enough people in this new town that they were forming, as well as, again, that proximity to trade, the healthiness, as they say, of the land, that they thought this could be a nice town. So they that's why they agreed to do it. And they had backers. They had financial backers.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because we have a question here from Twitter. Why don't we talk more about the Sugar Creek War? It's an awesome story and one we should all be talking about today. Sugar Creek War, I think, didn't that predate the establishment of Charlotte? You don't know, do you?
I'd have to.
This is why we don't talk
up.
About it. Nobody
yeah.
knows anything. Well, okay,
this
sorry.
Is why we're missing Dan Morrill. Dan Morrill is my go-to when you get to the early history of this community.
Dan Morrill would know. It wasn't long after the charter establishing Charlotte was signed that we split from the mother country. Lord Cornwallis, a British general who came through here and ultimately surrendered it at Yorktown to George Washington.
That was the end of the war.
Yeah, came through Charlotte not too much before the end of the war and found what he called a hornet's nest of rebellion. That's what he called us, a hornet's nest of rebellion, which is why we have the Charlotte Hornets and why the hornet is on the badge that the police department wears. As that came as the result of the Battle of Charlotte. And that actually started at the square. Did it not?
Mm-hmm. It did.
We'll talk about it.
Well, I think that why they were surprised to encounter this hornet's nest of rebellion here in Charlotte was because the British had received a lot of support from loyalists who were living in South Carolina. So when they came from the fall of Charleston in May of 1780, that was the largest port city in the nation at the time. And so this was a major victory for the British effort. And when they came up through this area, they were encountering this rebellious hornet's nest of patriotism that they didn't expect. They expected loyalism.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of what surprised them, why they thought we were a hornet's nest.
And there was an actual battle fought on the square with
yes.
gunfire and
yeah.
people
up
firing
up and down
back.
Tryon Street.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and it went out. It went up Tryon Street to what is now
Near Sugar Creek Church.
Right.
And Sugar Creek, named for the Sugar, probably was an Indian word for gathering place. So yet another indication that people were here before the Europeans got here.
They don't like it when I talk about this, but occasionally we have construction outside of our studio here at Spirit Square, and right now they are doing what we've done for 250 years, tearing up the sidewalk. So that's what they're doing, and that's what you hear in the background. If in fact you can hear it, we sure can hear it, let me tell you that. The epicenter of Charlotte and Charlotte history is the square. It's where it started. It's where the courthouse was. What corner was the courthouse on? Where was it? Do we know?
The courthouse, there were several courthouses, the ones that...
The original one, the one that they wanted to put and say, we have a town now, call us a town, call us Charlotte.
So I had have to almost look at our diorama. And I think that actually Jim Williams explained to me that one of the mistakes that they made when they created that original diorama was the way that it was facing, the way that the courthouse is facing. But I will have to go back and correct
that. But it's in
that.
The center of the square.
It is. Mm-hmm.
And that was a British thing. If you go to small towns in England today, the courthouse is right at the center of town. And it's a two-story building. It can be not a particularly grand building. The courthouse itself is sitting up on piers so that you can have a market underneath it.
Huh.
And there were at least a couple of early courthouses that were done that way, one out of log and then one, I think, out of brick. Like everything else here, couple, three, four, or five decades, they would tear down the courthouse and start over again.
Well, that is my next comment or question, because you say, Adria, that at any time, in our history, if a Charlottean has been away from town for 50 years and came back, they would not recognize the square that they remembered from 50 years ago. And that is true over five 50-year period from 250 years ago to today.
Well, absolutely.
It's more than that, isn't it? Why?
Is that
unusual for any city?
I think it's usual for a city that's experienced the growth that we have seen. So I grew up in Pennsylvania Dutch country in Pennsylvania. And when I go home, I see historic structures that are from the 18th, 19th century on every block. But it's not an area that has had a lot of economic development. There are not a lot of jobs coming into that area. There's no real reason to develop. And so Charlotte has both benefited from this development, and of course the historic preservation element has suffered.
Do you think that will change now? Because you specifically said that just about every generation in Charlotte would fail to recognize the square if they came back 50 years later. Well, now on the square, we have the Bank of America Tower. We have the Independence Tower, which is across the street. We have the other Bank of America building on the other corner. And then we have this park and another skyscraper on the fourth corner. It's hard to take down a skyscraper. I mean, are we kind of stuck with this look?
The Independence Center took down a skyscraper back in the 1980s.
How tall was it?
It was the tallest steel frame skyscraper in this part of the South.
I repeat, how tall was it? It wasn't 60 stories.
Nope, okay. But it seemed like it would last forever when it was built. So this is a city that reinvents itself. That's the essence of this new South that we have been living in since the Civil War, is this reinvention and reinvention.
So when we come back, we're going to hopscotch through Charlotte's history. We're going to just hop all over the place because 250 years ago was one thing, was nothing here. But then we're going to talk about some of the significant things that have happened over time and where they happened and what the impact of those things are or have been on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the early beginnings of Charlotte. We were founded on December 3rd, 1768, 250 years ago this year. And we're talking about it with historian Tom Hanchett, also Adria Vogt, historian with the Charlotte Museum of History. Let's do some hopscotching through our 50 years here. I mentioned in the opening that George Washington commented about our being a trifling place when he visited here in 1791. He wrote that in his journal after dining with Thomas Polk, one of the founders, on the square, at his home on the square. Do we know where that house was on the square, Thomas Polk's house?
It was in the location of the Bank of America Corporate Center.
Which is the big tower or the one across the street?
The one that's next to the Blumenthal.
Okay, so
it has all the points on the top.
Yeah, it's the big tower. So it was there. Wow. We were a trifling place then and languished evidently through the early 1800s because the eastern part of the state was where all the action was. Even when we were formed, that's where all the big towns were. What was the economy east? Was it just shipping and ports and farming?
Part of it was growing crops for the global market. That was why the colonies were established. And there was also the trade in naval stores, pitch and tar and things like that, that would cause people to get their feet sticky and be called Tar Heels.
And through the early 1800s, I'm told that North Carolina was losing out, commercially speaking, to Mississippi and Alabama because the state government saw no need to invest in education or infrastructure. This is a running theme.
The big turning point for Charlotte was when Charlotte quit waiting for North Carolina to build the North Carolina Railroad and built its own railroad, the Charlotte and South Carolina, which they raised money for here. Government put up some money. Farmers put up some money. And that's basically the route of the light rail in Charlotte, but it went down to Columbia and therefore to Charleston. And when that opened in the 1850s, the folks in Raleigh said, hey, we got to get on the stick, and they built the North Carolina Railroad over from Raleigh to Charlotte. So Charlotte was a railroad crossroads when you hit the Civil War.
And the reason I say this is a running theme, this desire not to see any, well, not a desire, but this ignoring the need for infrastructure, let's put it that way. the state government was shamed, evidently, into building roads for automobiles in the early part of the 20th century, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, by Grady Cole, who was the morning personality at WBT back in the early, early days of radio. And he would get on there and just shame them about having terrible roads in the state.
Well, slightly before that, a fellow named Cameron Morrison, who was the governor of North Carolina.
Became the good roads governor, didn't he?
Became the good roads governor, convinced the state legislature to put out a massive bond issue. And that was the beginning of paving roads statewide. And that's one of the things that put Charlotte at the forefront, North Carolina at the forefront. But Cameron Morrison owned a big farm in his later years that became the South Park area.
Right. Let's talk about gold. The discovery of gold here in 1799 led to a gold rush through the 1830s.
Kind of a gold trickle. Yeah. Compared to California. California in 1849, that was a gold rush. But here we did have folks coming here. We had a mint in 1837. First mint outside of Philadelphia.
Thanks to President Andrew Jackson, who's from Waxhaw, right, I believe. So what did the presence or the establishment of the U.S. Mint mean to Charlotte? What did it do, if anything?
It brought some immigrants. A number of folks came from other parts of the world to be part of us. It helped Charlotte grow in the early 19th century. Of course, when the California Gold Rush happened, Charlotte languished and the mint became not a used place and was eventually torn down. Imagine that. But they saved it, and you can still see the original mint out in the back part of the Mint Museum of Art off Randolph Road.
So they actually took the building apart
moved
it.
Yeah. It used to stand on Mint Street. Once upon a time, Mint Street made sense.
Right. As so much of Charlotte. Then there's James K. Polk, another president of the United States from Pineville. He would come into office in 1845. Did we benefit from his presence in the White House in any way? No. Okay. how important was the arrival of the railroad in 1852? What did that do?
I think it's the biggest game changer we ever had.
Ever?
Yeah. Because at that point, there were no railroads into this part of the Carolinas. And if that railroad had gone to Lincolnton, we would be sitting amidst the skyscrapers of Lincolnton today.
Really?
That was what got us started.
Okay.
And the railway brought all of the trade and means of transportation for the textile industry to flourish here.
Yeah. First mill in Charlotte was in 1881. By the 1920s, this area had overtaken New England as the textile manufacturing center for the United States.
Why?
And so,
why did that happen? It happened about 15 years after the War of Northern Aggression.
Partly was that the land here was good for growing cotton, and once you had railroads to take it to the coast, that opened up that. Also, we had inexpensive labor compared to New England. In New England, the wages were rising. Here, whole families would come off the farm and go to work in the textile mills.
The textile boom, I'm told, and correct me if I'm wrong, began with the opening of the Charlotte Cotton Mill. Is that right?
Still exists. Okay. It's on Graham at 5th Street.
Graham at 5th.
That was way out at the edge of town back then.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Grant, it's what is it now?
It has been renovated by Charlotte-Mecklenburg Historic Landmarks Commission in partnership with a series of developers. There's housing. I think that what was in the mill itself went out recently. It was a night bar and nightclub, and I'm not sure what's going in there right now.
We don't talk much in Charlotte about our association with the great unpleasantness or the Civil War to most other Americans, otherwise known. Where did we stand on secession? The first articles of secession were voted in Charleston in South Carolina. They did it, and then off we go to the war. Where did we stand? Did we take a position? Anybody in Charlotte take a position on secession? Because this was not a great big slavery area, was it?
There were about 40% of us, I think 38, 39, something like that, were African American right before the war, and almost all of those folks were enslaved. We did not have big plantations here, but we had small-scale slavery. And this, the Mecklenburg County, the representatives from here voted in favor of secession. Mm. Once you got a little bit west of here, where there was much less slavery, that's where the real opposition to the war took place.
We were, during the war, we were the site of the Confederate Navy Yard, which I found.
Boy, yeah, when I heard that, I said, no wonder they lost, you know? No, there's no water here. But well, yes, well, it made sense because we had two railroads. And what the Confederate Navy Yard did was to make the stuff that the boats and other fighting groups needed. And so, yeah, we had the Confederate
Navy
Yard.
Why not do it at the coast?
Because
why depend on a railroad that might or might not be usable?
Because the Union forces were capturing the coast. Mm. As soon as the Union forces began.
Well, then how did you get the stuff from the railroad cars in Charlotte down to the coast and onto the ships?
Because the railroads went in multiple directions, wherever the Confederacy continued to hold pieces of the coast, you could get material from Charlotte.
And the Confederacy did move toward the end. Jefferson Davis has a plaque on Tryon Street.
That's true.
When
Richmond fell, Davis came down that railroad with his entire cabinet.
Right.
And by some accounts, the last meeting, full meeting of the Confederate cabinet was here in Charlotte.
There's a plaque, and I'm trying to think what restaurant is there right now, but right outside one of the restaurants on Tryon Street, on the western side of Tryon Street, there is a plaque that says it was on this spot in 1865 that Jefferson Davis heard of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Is it safe to say that because he came down on the railroad with his cabinet, fleeing what had happened in Richmond, that this was the last capital of the Confederacy?
There's a book to that effect, with I think that title, that is quite well reasoned. Pieces of the cabinet continued on with him moving further south, and so there are a number of cities that make that claim, but Charlotte seems to have a pretty good.
Our colleague Glenn Birkins, who is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, has an interesting story on this 250th birthday of Charlotte that talks about, not a story, but landmarks, I guess, that talk about the landmarks of African-American participation in Charlotte.
Yeah, African-American history has been so important here. About a quarter of us have been African-American, sometimes higher percentages of that. And if you go to QCityMetro.com, there are 8 moments in Charlotte's black history as we celebrate its 250th birthday, beginning with one of that's my particular favorite is the chartering of the school that became Johnson C. Smith University. Hmm. Johnson C. Smith today, a liberal arts college just west of Uptown, but back in the day, it was the denominational college for African-American Presbyterians all over the Southeast, and a tremendous center of learning and a tremendous center of energy. And it's not the only religious center here. The AME Zion Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, has its national headquarters in Charlotte now. And the United House of Prayer for All People had its first big revival here, now another national African-American denomination.
Historian Dan Morrill, who was supposed to be here, says that there are two running themes to the history of Charlotte from the very beginning. One is the boosterism, the trying to become more than we are and become a center of commerce, which arguably we have achieved. And the other is racial tension, he says. Two great themes. Between whites and blacks, racial tension between whites and blacks, most recently between everybody else and Latinos, but that whenever the two come into conflict, boosterism wins out in Charlotte, he says. So let's talk about that, because we appointed a black police officer here in 1868. That's early. In 1877, the first recorded protest for integration occurred at the Opera House here, wherever that was. When did tensions amplify into this racial tension that he talks about, and how have we handled it? And we only have about a minute and a half.
This has been a center for African-American achievement dating back to at least Johnson C. Smith University, and that presence has helped Charlotte more gracefully handle a lot of turning points in the civil rights movement. Desegregation of restaurants happened here in 1960 when a lot of other cities resisted. 1963, upscale restaurants.
Quickly and quietly because of cooperative leadership between blacks and whites.
Right, because people knew how to talk to each other, and that's one of the ongoing themes of Charlotte. Charlotte that helped us when Charlotte was the test case for court-ordered busing right. in 1971, Swan versus Mecklenburg. And this city became well known for its successful integration of schools.
So if the past is prologue, what do you anticipate for the next 250 years?
You're asking a historian to predict the future.
Yeah.
I think we're going to keep growing. That's been the main engine of our history making has been this continuous growth. There's never been a decade since the railroads came that we have not grown. And that's also our biggest challenge, which is how to create a community in this city of newcomers.
I want to thank Adria Folk, President and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History, and Tom Hanchett with HistorySouth.org. Thank you both for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.